This Climate One podcast is sponsored by General Motors. How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
From the Commonwealth Club of California, this is Climate One, leading the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. Presidential candidate Donald Trump has said climate change is a hoax, and if elected, he would remove the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Hillary Clinton would uphold the Paris deal, and her clean energy plan calls for 500 million new solar panels in the next 5 years and $60 billion for cities and states to construct green buildings and new transit. In California, there's a different power story. Republican former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Democratic Governor Jerry Brown recently threw a party together to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the state's main climate law, which Schwarzenegger signed and Brown recently extended with the help of a Republican vote. On the show today, we will discuss what California is doing this election year to green its economy despite gridlock in Washington. The fuel fight is often not on the top of mind for voters, but it is playing a central role in at least one Southern California assembly race. And several new laws come into effect next year that will impact the electricity that runs our toys and the food that comes to our kitchen tables. Over the next hour, we'll discuss electric cars, transit, housing, jobs, water, and other issues affected by our changing climate. We're joined now by three guests. Kevin DeLeon is President Pro Tem of the California State Senate. He's the first Latino to hold that position in 130 years. He was a community organizer in Los Angeles before being elected to the state assembly 10 years ago. Melanie Mason is a political reporter in Sacramento for the Los Angeles Times. She previously covered the 2012 U.S. election from Washington, D.C., and is now covering national and state politics. Antonio Villaraigosa is former mayor of Los Angeles. He was the first Latino to hold that position in over 100 years. He also served as Speaker of the California State Assembly and has been active on the national political stage. He co-chaired the 2012 Democratic National Convention and was co-chair of Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Please welcome them to Climate One.
Melanie Mason.
Thank you all for being here. I should note that we invited several Republican legislators and elected officials in California. Some wanted to come, couldn't make this date, and we will have them at another time. Welcome to you all. I'd like to start with Senator DeLeon. How can California support a growing population and grow its economy and tackle climate change? Can it do all of those things at the same time?
I think we're doing it right now as we speak. I think we have successfully delinked and decoupled GDP from carbon, which means that we are less carbon intensive. And today, we're not the sixth largest economy in the world, but I just found out early this morning. California, in fact, is the fifth largest economy in the world. To put that in context, obviously, the United States of America as a whole in the aggregate has the largest GDP on planet Earth. Then it's China, Japan, Germany, and now it seems like we've surpassed the United Kingdom as well as France. And we've done so with intentionality and a sense of purpose with regards to our carbon targets that we've laid out. We have sent very clear market signals to venture capitalists because we have received over 60% of the venture capital is coming to California in the clean energy space. We have a very ambitious renewable portfolio standard, which is 50% by the year 2030. I think it's very ambitious, but I believe that the IOUs as well as the MOUs will meet that target way before 2030. And as a result, we've created more than 500,000 jobs. Now, these are jobs that are real, that are tangible, that you can verify. They're not jobs that you can outsource to another state or offshore to Guangzhou, China, or elsewhere. They are in the clean energy space. And it hasn't been by happenstance. And letting the market forces, whether they're regional, national, or global, create these jobs, we actually have done it by the policies that we have moved forward in the state capital. And again, we have delinked and decoupled carbon from GDP because the last point I want to make on this is understandably that if you wanted to raise a family buy a house, send your kid off to college, then the narrative was that you'd have to grow the economy by burning fossil fuels. And largely, we have become the largest GDP on planet Earth by burning fossil fuels. But we know that narrative is old now. We've debunked that, and we've proven that you can decouple, delink carbon, and grow the economy at the same time. And we've done so quite successfully in California.
Mayor Villaraigosa, climate change seems to be often a remote issue for people in California. Think of melting glaciers, polar bears. How do you make it relevant to people who think climate, well, maybe there's storms in Florida, but how do you make it relevant as a concern to people in California?
Jobs. You know, and economic development. In 1994, when I first got elected, maybe 30%, 25 to 30% of Democrats were taking on the AQMD, the Air Quality Management District, basically buying into the business argument that cleaning up the air had the effect of undermining the business community and particularly manufacturing in L.A. And Hilda Solis and I, back in 1994, led the effort to say, hold it. We don't buy this jobs blackmail argument that, in fact, you can create jobs and build a clean tech environment, develop the technologies in California. At the time, I was talking about L.A., that you can export and create jobs around the world. And that, you know, has been the framework for Fabian Nunez 10 years ago now with AB 32. Kevin De Leon this year extending it. I think for a long time now, there are many of us here in California have understood that we can grow the economy and clean up our environment. And so I think jobs is critical. And in that vein, let me just say this. I've been an environmentalist, number one American city in the 8 years I was mayor in reducing carbon emissions. We signed on to Kyoto in 2005 by Kyoto says you reduce carbon emissions by 7% of 1990 levels by 2012. We were at 28%. Only London, Copenhagen, number one at 40, Berlin at 36, Toronto at 34, LA at 28. Went from 3% renewables to 20%, but we were always focused on a clean tech sector. We always understood that we had to create jobs too, so that we didn't. And we always understood that we had to focus on environmental justice. The problem with the environmental movement, and it's been true for a very long time, is they focus a lot on the abstract and not enough on the concrete. And the people who disproportionately suffer from the effects of climate change are poor people, people of color. We saw that at the port of Los Angeles, where we reduced truck emissions by more than 90%. The people that were dying of respiratory diseases in that area were, you know, poor people and people of color who lived around these areas. So if you don't connect this to jobs and to environmental justice, you're missing the real point of why we have to address climate change. And both Kevin De Leon and Fabian Nunez understood that with AB 32 and its extension. And I did the Carl Moyer Act, which was the largest expansion of enforcing the Clean Air Act until AB 32. And the efforts we did were always focused around jobs and environmental justice.
AB 32 being California's landmark climate law that's 10 years old right now. Senator De Leon, a lot of critics, though, of that law say that it doesn't do enough for communities of color. There's been a lot of environmental justice critics of cap and trade, the mechanism put in place, saying it allows people, companies to buy, clean up other places and not really the Richmonds and Martinez and El Segundos sure. of the state.
Well, there is some truth to it, no doubt. I mean, there's two ways of going about it. Either a carbon tax, and if you can secure a two-thirds vote, which means you need Republican support on both sides, both chambers, or a market mechanism such as cap and trade. And as you just alluded to, it gives polluters the opportunity to pay for their pollution and purchase the credits necessary, and therefore the auction revenues. But what we have done with Senate Bill 535, a measure that I authored, is we take a minimum baseline of 25% of all the auction revenues. And we're talking now hundreds of millions of dollars. And what we've done, as Mayor Villaraigosa just mentioned a few moments ago, we've invested these dollars in communities that are disproportionately impacted by both co-pollutants, in other words, GHG, carbon, CO2, as well as other criteria pollutants, such as NOx, SOx, particulate matter 2.5, where our children breathe into their lungs every single day. And the number one reason for absenteeism in our public school system is due to asthma. So what are the programs specifically? Rooftop solar, distributive generation, rebates that you can bundle together to purchase an electric vehicle, energy efficiency, parks and green space, as well as tree planting, particularly in urban areas where you have heat islands where the temperature rises incredibly so. When you focus on those communities, in other words, when you democratize your climate change policies, and this is a very unusual concept for the rest of the country, even progressives on the East Coast and even very enlightened nations in Scandinavia, whether it's Denmark or Sweden or Germany or elsewhere, when you democratize your climate change policies with intentionality in a sense of purpose, what you're doing is you're making sure that those who are most vulnerable to criteria pollutants and to the catastrophic impacts of climate change, that they become much more resilient. And what you do, too, is distributive generation, rooftop, or electric vehicle. Now, I like to always ask, how many folks drive an electric vehicle? Because if only those who have the financial wherewithal have access to the latest and greatest technologies, and therefore you're an early adopter because you have the money to adopt early, irrespective of the price point, we'll actually never reach our macro global targets. In other words, if you live in Marin, if you live in Pacific Heights or Palo Alto or Menlo Park or in Santa Monica or Malibu or Pacific Palisades or Brentwood or La Jolla in Southern California, that you have to incorporate communities of color in the Central Valley, in Los Angeles, in Richmond, in East Oakland, in East San Jose because of the emissions that are committed. And if you don't, it becomes very boutique-ish. And you have to normalize the medium. If not, again, that means only those who have the financial wherewithal and high educational attainment, who are conscientious with regards to their decision-making in purchasing an electric vehicle, whether it's a Tesla or any other type. I want distributed generation, or I have the resources to retrofit and upgrade my, you know, palatial house, you know, next to Golden Gate Park or Fort Mason, whatever, et cetera. You know, we're not going to reach our target goals. So it behooves all of us, irrespective of income level, to make sure we democratize our climate change policies.
Melanie Mason, you came in from Ohio today. You've been covering the national political campaign. You worked for a Texas newspaper. We hear two elected officials here in California talking about clean energy as a winning political strategy. How does that compare to what you're seeing in Ohio and other swing states during this election campaign?
Oh, it's whiplash. I mean, entirely. I mean, the difference is that in California, politicians can't stop talking about climate change, and elsewhere, no one wants to talk about climate change. It's pretty stunning, I think, the difference in terms of the rhetoric and the sort of action that you're seeing on the state level as opposed to national. And there are a couple exceptions, I think. I mean, of course, national Democrats are embracing climate policies much more so than their Republican counterparts. One interesting thing that I saw recently is Tom Steyer's group, so the environmental activist, they are now advertising directly to millennials, saying, if you're thinking about going over to Gary Johnson, for example, for a third-party vote, you should know about his stance on climate change, because he does not exactly have the most progressive policy proposals on climate change, sort of using the climate change issue to directly target millennials who might be maybe moving away from Hillary Clinton. But that's very niche. I mean, it is so different from out here in California, where climate sort of seeps into so many different political issues. Out on the campaign trail, I hear about it basically never.
Really? Let's talk about the voting bloc, the Latino voting bloc. There's been a lot written about that, Mayor Villaraigosa. You've said that they feel these issues because they're close to it, they're breathing it, et cetera. But does that mean that they will then consider that when they go to the ballot box? Because the conventional wisdom is people don't vote on energy climate issues. They vote on maybe health care, pocketbook issues.
Well, that's why I think you have to connect it to jobs and job creation and to jobs that there's a pipeline for that community to be able to attain. So as an example, you know, everything we did around climate change, we connected to developing a clean tech community. We got USC, UCLA, Caltech, but also trade tech and the community colleges to help with solar installation and other clean tech jobs that don't require a four-year education. So we were always focused around job creation because that's the issue that, frankly, transcends all communities. People want a job. They want economic development. So we, because I had been doing this for a few years now, since 94, because we had always understood that the biggest argument about doing all of the things around cleaning up the air and the water and moving to was this fact that we were losing jobs in the old economy. So we argued we need to create jobs in the new economy, but make sure that there's a pipeline for all communities, and particularly the communities that have been most impacted and usually are at the end of the line when it comes to job distribution. So, you know, we were focused on that, and that's how we kind of got a broader community behind these issues. I mean, when we first started doing this tonight, this is 2016. I mean, everybody in this town is for it. When we were doing this in 94, I mean, like, I'm telling you, there was a sizable group of Democrats that bought in to the notion that this was a job killer. A sizable group, a 30%, 25 to 30% group of Democrats that were very much against it, and oftentimes led by communities of color. You know, as an example, when I did the Parks Bond, largest Parks Bond in U.S. history, a $2 billion bond, $2.1 billion bond, the agreement with the environmental community who, before that bond, all of the parks went to suburban areas. And I said, hold it. We're going to put parks where people are. I'll give you your $2 billion bond, but you're giving me, you know, urban parks. So all of this was always around connecting. Let's sell this as based on, you know, addressing equity issues, but also sell it as President Pro Tem just said, by building a broader coalition and a bigger majority for it. So that's the way we dealt with it. And, you know, by the way, I mean, I want to be really clear, as much as we've acknowledged the legislature and certainly the role of both Speaker Nunez and President Pro Tem, you know, De Leon, L.A. didn't wait, and neither did San Francisco, by the way, on Sacramento. You know, we were moving this. I went from 3% to 20% renewables, dirtiest public utility in the United States, before AB 32. We were moving. We weren't going to wait on the legislature. Obviously, once they did it, it provided a broader, you know, regulatory environment for us and you know, political support. But, you know, San Francisco has been doing this for a while, last time I looked. And, you know, L.A.'s, you know, a country in the sense that it's so big and got a big Republican and a big business community that was oppositional. But we sold them. And this was good for business.
Antonio Villaraigosa is a former mayor of Los Angeles. Our other guests today are Kevin DeLeon, president of the California State Senate, and political reporter Melanie Mason from the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Dalton. Senator DeLeon, Mayor Villaraigosa just mentioned Democratic opposition. There's a race right now for the assembly in San Bernardino where there's an African-American woman, and the incumbent who blocked Governor Brown's climate agenda is being challenged by another Democrat, a Latina. $2.3 million has already been pumped into this race. Chevron put in $1 million. Sheryl Brown is called Chevron Sheryl. Tell us, what does that mean about the politics of energy in this state? First of all, $2.5 million on an assembly seat and two Democrats going after each other, largely around energy and climate.
Well, obviously, you know, for the reformers, it's a byproduct of the top two primary system, where now instead of having a Republican versus a Democrat, you have a Dem on Dem. In this case, what is perceived to be a more progressive Dem versus a more moderate to conservative Democrat. I think that when it comes to energy, when it comes to climate change and clean air and clean water, I do believe strongly, because I've seen the empirical evidence. It's not just anecdotal. But I've seen the data, poll after poll, that communities of color, in fact, score the highest. And then when you throw a second test at them, and I mean you throw the kitchen sink at them, if you support climate change policies, the economy will be destroyed. Your utility rates will go through the roof. You will lose your job as a result. When you test them on a second round, they stay strong and steady. They don't equivocate. It is white males who are the ones who start going south very, very quickly. And I've seen the empirical evidence and the data on various polls and instruments. So communities of color, Latinas especially, Asian Americans and African Americans stay very strong. And it runs contrary to the old narrative that communities of color really don't believe in climate change, or this is an issue that's the Bill McKibbins of the world, or if you read Mother Jones, you know, and, you know, it's sort of kind of that domain. And this is what Antonio just mentioned, which is really critical, because it's actually expanding and opening up your coalition and being inclusive and more diverse. Because for some folks, the environment begins and ends at the beach. And that's simply not the reality for a lot of other folks. And so what you're seeing being played out in the Inland Empire in San Bernardino are two very strong, you know, Democrats, a highly competitive seat. It is a what is perceived a progressive clean energy person versus a more conservative, moderate Democrat who's supported by the fossil fuel industry. We'll see how it plays itself out. But I don't think this will be the last that you'll see in the state of California, either in Southern California, Central Valley, or in the Bay Area.
Melanie Mason, usually races don't turn on energy, this sort of thing. What do you make of that race in the Inland Empire? What does it portend? And you're covering national politics now, but you know about this race.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll be a little bit of a Debbie Downer up here, because I think when we're talking about this, there's a lot of understandable pride about the progress that's been made. But if you were listening to this, you would think that Democrats all were on board and maybe it was some recalcitrant Republicans. Yeah. And that's not the case. I mean, the case out here, and we saw this last year when a major piece of energy legislation that the senator had sponsored ended up having to get gutted in some senses with regards to the oil reduction provision. There were lots of other important parts of that bill, but the oil reduction provision, they were going to slash oil use in the state by 50%. That ended up having to be taken out of the bill, and it wasn't Republicans that were blocking this. It was Democrats, and what's sort of known in the Capitol parlance as the mods, the moderate Democrats. And these are Democrats that are tend to be seen as closer to business interests, closer to maybe oil or agriculture. And they were the ones that were throwing a wrench into what was this very ambitious climate program. And so I think that this race in San Bernardino is kind of a great sort of proxy war for sort of what is the soul of the Democratic Party going to be on this issue and on other issues. Because you have, you know, the Democrats, they run the state house. And so the question is if the mods are going to be a little recalcitrant in some of these ambitious climate policies, what does the Democratic Party do about that? Do they try and oust incumbent mods with more progressive members? And that's what's playing out right now in San Bernardino. That's why you see so much money going in. And I think that the senator is right. We're going to be seeing these races play out because of the top two system much more. That's the new dynamic. It's not D versus R. It's what type of Democrat are you?
So, Millie Mason, what do you think the legislature composition might be in Sacramento after this election? Is it going to be a big difference, or just a few seats here and there? What's Jerry Brown going to have in the legislature for his last 2 years?
Well, I think the big question is, does he have a supermajority in both houses? I mean, I think that the assumption is that Democrats will gain, especially in the Assembly, and the Senator can tell us what the sort of outlook is in his chamber. But, you know, it's a presidential year that tends to be a more Democratic electorate. So I think that we can anticipate, I've heard 54 is what you need in the Assembly for two-thirds. I've heard upwards of 58, 59 potential members. So that's two-thirds and then some. And, of course, two-thirds, as the senator alluded to earlier, that's a magic threshold, because that's when you can start passing taxes. And so then you have the question of, are we talking about a carbon tax now? Are we talking about reauthorizing the cap and trade program to get rid of some legal ambiguity that it's facing right now, because there's a question of if it's a tax or not? So I think what we'll see after next month, if Democrats control a supermajority in the state house, then the question is sort of how far do they want to run?
Senator Dale.
Let me add something. Let me just, and this, again, this is just my perspective. I've always believed that the two-thirds threshold is highly overrated, and I think it's sort of this this incredible holy grail, if you will, for folks. If you receive a two-thirds, and that's the panacea to all the economic and social ills that plague the state of California. If, in fact, there are two-thirds in either chamber, and I'll play down the possibilities for the Senate, on the Senate side, I won't speak on behalf of the Assembly. Most likely, they're from very conservative areas, number one. Two, this is a presidential year, so obviously there'll be a large, huge turnout. But I don't know if there'll be a lot of Democrats who are up to, quote-unquote, raising taxes, because when they're up for re-election every 2 years, like the Congress, the next swing will be during a non-presidential year. Therefore, do they want to be on the record in terms of raising taxes? Now, that's just my own independent objective analysis. So this two-thirds issue tends to be, through my estimation, more hyped up. We've had it before, and revenues were not raised, and I don't believe those individuals who were on the bubble of the two-thirds, that made the two-thirds, were eager to dive in and raise any type of revenue. But Melanie makes a very salient point. The issue is, will we, if we do receive a two-thirds in either chamber, will we move a carbon tax, or will we move to remove any legal ambiguity and vagueness with regards to the legal validity of a cap-and-trade program with regards to an extension of cap-and-trade? Because of cap-and-trade, we're able to invest in rebates for low-income communities. In fact, this year, there will be $80 million. $80 million that's on the table for low-income families to bundle the rebates together to purchase perhaps a Nissan Leaf. And in fact, with Senate Bill 350, what we're doing is we're transforming our whole transportation, electric transportation infrastructure system, because if you had the money, you had your own charging station. But soon, charging stations with PG&E up here in the Bay Area, with Southern California Edison, Sempra Energy in Southern Cal, as well as the MOU,
DWP. Municipal-owned utility.
There will, yeah, municipal MOU, municipally-owned utility, investor-owned utility. They will be building out transportation electrification infrastructure. So charging stations will, in fact, be ubiquitous, just like gas stations. And for the first time in the history of the United States of America, energy companies, specifically IOUs and MOUs, will be competing for the same market share with the fossil fuel industry. Historically, if I'm Pacific Gas and Electric, I am selling you energy to power your house, your business, your car, or not your car so much, but your house and your business. Now they will actually be in the same marketplace competing with the fossil fuel industry as they build out transportation electrification. And when you see a Chevron, a Tesoro, a Valero, ExxonMobil, what have you, et cetera, you're going to be seeing charging stations all over. And that's when you democratize, and that's when you start normalizing the medium, and that's when you have a revolutionary balance, a change and shift, if you will, and that's when you're going to get a lot of electric vehicles on the road in California.
Another piece of this, Mayor Villaraigosa, is transit. Something amazing is happening in Los Angeles, the city car mecca of the world. There's actually a real functioning subway happening there that started with Measure R. What's the ridership numbers like, and is it possible that L.A. will be a walkable transit city in our lifetime?
It actually started with my mom. My mom rode a bus her whole life. I was sitting on the RTD board in 1992.
It's the Rapid Transit District.
Right. And right after the civil disturbances argued for a 50-cent fare program to build ridership, because like the civil disturbances of 65 in Watts, when they did an analysis of what some of the issues were in these communities, transportation and affordability were a big part of it. And so it started with my mom because she wrote the bus. And once I sat on the MTA board, for a brief period, I chaired transportation here. I said that we were going to move LA from the single car passenger capital of the world to a place where we're reimagining the city. And and one where we were addressing the affordability issue. So Measure R was about reimagining the city, about the job-housing balance, about connecting every community, about making sure we had a first-class bus system, not just a first-class rail system, and about keeping fares low and subsidies high. So the first 5 years of Measure R, which was a $40 billion initiative over a 30-year period of time, was keeping the fares right where they were. Again, trying to connect the issue of transportation, cleaning up the air with communities that have historically been, you know, left behind. I think that's the difference in leadership that, you know, as California changes, you know, there are people who have represented communities that have been left behind for so long that we say, hey, if we want to win, and I do want to speak to their two-thirds in just a minute, if we want to win, and we've got to build a broader coalition, which means we have to be more inclusive, which means we've got to be investing in those communities that were left behind. So, you know, just as you said on climate change, the communities that were behind Measure R at the highest rate, Watts, the East Side, all the poorer areas of LA, disproportionately higher, just like our school bonds, just like the climate change polling that the Senate president talks about. So this was a strategic, deliberative effort on our part to build a broader coalition. As you know, we built one busway, three rail lines, and we're in construction in two more, more than any other city during that period and more than any other administration in LA history. But it wasn't just about moving people, cleaning up the air. It was about job creation, building jobs. We did project labor agreements where we said 38% of the people that work on this are the people that voted for it. So it was very deliberative and very focused on building a broader coalition for these things, for cleaning up the air, for addressing the respiratory illness issues, which were disproportionately in the poor areas, making it affordable for people, building affordable housing along transit lines. It was broader than just building rail.
Antonio Villarosa is a former mayor of Los Angeles. Other guests today at Climate One are Senate President Kevin DeLeon and Melanie Mason from the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Dalton, and we're going to go to our lightning round, where we ask each of our guests a brief series of yes, no, true or false questions. Starting with Mayor Villarosa, yes or no, considering what you know about rising temperatures and rising seas, if you suddenly came into millions of dollars, you would buy a beachfront house in Malibu.
No.
Senator DeLeon, in California, yes or no, rich people breathe cleaner air than poor people?
Yes. No doubt.
Melanie Mason, true or false, many politicians worry privately about the soaring costs of California's high-speed rail project, but they don't dare say so in public for fear of criticizing Governor Jerry Brown's pet project.
True.
Senator DeLeon, yes or no, you're glad that I didn't ask you that question.
Sure.
Mayor Villarosa, in your lifetime, rising temperatures will drive some people to move from Southern California to Northern California.
No.
Senator DeLeon, in your lifetime, lack of fresh water will force people to move their homes and businesses from parched parts of the state.
Yes, no doubt.
Melanie Mason, Northern California is a better place to live anyways.
Oh, false.
Now, you're talking to three LA people, by the way. You know, I love the Bay Area, everybody.
Senator DeLeon, what grade would you give Arnold Schwarzenegger for his time as governor?
I didn't serve I did serve a couple years. So I think about it. You know, on climate change, I'd give him an A, no doubt.
Mayor Villarosa, what grade would you give Arnold Schwarzenegger's films?
F, Arnold, I love you, but I can't give you. They make a lot of money. But
also, Mayor Villarosa, former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom would be a strong California governor.
No.
Was it pass or fail? What was it?
Yes, no, maybe.
You know, look, Gavin's is a talented person and certainly qualified to be governor, and so are a lot of other people.
Senator DeLeon, Antonio Villaraigosa would be a strong California governor.
I think so, very much so. And I think that you want folks who actually have real accomplishments that can be verified and not just articulated in speeches.
Also for Senator DeLeon, you and Mayor Villaraigosa both have ambitions of being California's first Latino governor.
I'm happy in my current role as president of the Senate.
Melanie Mason, you're enjoying watching these two politicians answer these questions.
Absolutely.
Melanie Mason, you predict billionaire Tom Steyer will run for California governor in 2018.
Oh. I'm actually stumped. Yeah, I'll say yes.
Melanie Mason, you predict investor Steve Wesley will also run for governor in 2018.
Yes.
Kevin DeLeon, in 2008, Los Angeles voters approved an increase to sales tax. We've been talking about Measure R, $40 billion over 30 years for new transit lines and freeways. Mayor Villaraigosa gets too much credit for the passage of that measure, yes or no?
No, he does not get enough credit.
Mayor Villaraigosa, Kevin DeLeon got too much credit for recent passage of a law extending California's fight against global warming.
Yes. No, he didn't get enough credit. He battled for that and should have had a lot more people in powerful positions supporting him.
Let's give them a round of applause for that lightning round. They got through the gauntlet.
And now, here's a Climate 1 minute. California may be leading the charge on climate change, but on the national level, it's a different story. With Congress pretty much split along party lines, how's any progress to be made? U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, who's on the front lines of that battle, says there are some places where even Democrats and Republicans can agree.
I believe the innovation agenda is really the key. We have had extensive discussions about this in the Congress with both chambers, both parties. And the innovation agenda is one that resonates very, very strongly. It's advancing business. In addition to advancing our climate goals, our security goals, our economic goals, it's also going to be about building new infrastructure. Labor is all into the innovation and infrastructure agenda. Look, the reality is in Paris, certainly no one can dispute the fact that every country in the world basically came forward and said we have to address this. Now, there may be individuals who would like to take a different position. But I have not heard any of them take a different position on innovation, on the fact that the United States has always led in innovation, that it gives us tremendous opportunity economically. And I think that's the key. This is the bipartisan message. This is the message that will, again, I think, carry us across the finish line in terms of the dramatically increased ambition we will need in the decades ahead.
That's U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who spoke to Climate One in January. Now back to Greg Dalton and his guests at the Commonwealth Club.
We touched on housing earlier, and I want to come back to housing. Senator DeLeon, there's a housing crisis in this state. There's talk of a $3 billion bond for state funding. Climate change seems pretty remote when you're being priced out of your neighborhood. And what can, and we'll get to the mayor also, be done about the housing crisis that Californians are feeling, especially here in the Bay Area?
Well, listen, I used to live in the Bay Area. I used to live right across the street from the Panhandle, near Mason, between Cole and Stanyan. And my hospital was St. Mary's, and my parish was St. Ignatius Church. And I know the housing crisis is unlike any other place in the nation. Obviously, I live... And I represent an area that our mayor used to represent as Assembly Member and Speaker, Echo Park and Silver Lake, the same displacement issue. Senator Jim Bell from the South Bay, from San Jose, who is my chair of transportation and housing, has moved forward a $3 billion bond to help alleviate the housing crisis in California. I'm hoping to work very closely with the Speaker, Anthony Rendon, and to convince our Governor, Jerry Brown, that it is important that we do take on some more debt to deal with this housing crisis, because the displacement issue of folks having to travel so far away to drive into the city, to drive into Los Angeles, the carbon footprint that's increased, how you disrupt families. We really have to, at a state, at a federal, but not so much the federal, because the feds have not been that helpful, but it's at the state level and at the local level, the county board of supervisors here in San Francisco, city council members dealing with the issue of NIMBYism. We have to collectively really roll up our sleeves and tackle this together, because if we allow the NIMBYism forces, voices to be the loudest, well, the problem doesn't go away with regards to housing. And it's not just impacting those at the lowest economic strata. We're talking about middle-class families as well, too. So there's a major problem, there's a major crisis, and Democrats and Republicans have to unite and come together to deal with this issue. And I'm hoping that we can work out a deal with the Assembly. I know Assemblymember David Chu here in San Francisco is a very strong advocate, as well as Tony Thurman across the bay in Richmond. I think we can put our heads together, and I do predict in the year 2017, the issue of housing will be one of the top three issues that the legislature will tackle.
Mayor Villaraigosa, if you were statewide, $3 billion is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money for California real estate.
If I was statewide, what?
Looking statewide, $3 billion is a lot of money. It's not for property in California. What's the solution to the house? Is it more supply? How do you get more supply?
Three things. Jobs, housing, transportation. You got to connect all three. And you got to make sure that you have a focus on affordability and that the jobs aren't just for the upper and middle class or upper middle class and up, but for working people and people coming from poverty to the middle class. You got to connect it. Without that, it doesn't work. And $3 billion is not nearly enough. $3 billion wouldn't be enough in San Francisco. It's not enough in L.A. And actually, you know, what people don't realize about the L.A. San Francisco, they're actually very comparable. San Francisco has higher housing and rental prices than L.A., but we have a bigger gap in terms of affordability, because L.A. has a higher poverty rate than the San Francisco area by leaps. I think we're 14th in the country. I don't know if, I mean, the reason why I keep on connecting these things and the impact, top 300 cities with high poverty rates, 77 of them are in California. Three of the top five are in the Central Valley. LA's 14th, San Bernardino's 9th. I mean, we're the epicenter. As well as we're doing, I'm a big believer, and I know the Senate president as well. You know, we've got to, if we're going to thrive in the 21st century, we have to thrive together. We can't create the chasms of, you know, of wealth between communities that you see. And so any housing effort has to be focused on affordability, on homelessness, on making sure that working people can live with the rest of us. And it's, you know, I'm not speaking Democrat or Republican here. If we want a society where we're growing together and we have social cohesion, we can't walk over the homeless every single day and think it's okay, and maybe give a few bucks for it. You know, we have to fill it in here. And so it's got to create jobs. It's got to connect jobs to housing and transportation. By the way, so that we're really clear, I do support high-speed rail. You know, 16 countries either have it or are building it. But we've got to be smarter about how we leverage it. We've got to leverage jobs and housing and spread out the jobs. I was just with the Bay Area Council a few minutes ago, and we've got to address the fact that in the Central Valley, and I've spent 44 days on a listening tour, 22 of them in the Central Valley, they're not growing with the Bay Area or the west side of Los Angeles. And if we're going to thrive, we've got to connect those. And I think you can do it through housing, you know, the housing, transportation, and job balance. That's how you leverage, you know, and it's got to be bigger than $3 billion.
Great. Senator DeLeon?
Yeah, I want to add, because that's a very important point that the mayor brings up. And as I stated earlier today, if you let the market forces fend for themselves, the inequities or the chasm, the gulf, if you will only widen in the wealthiest state, in the wealthiest nation in the world. And that's why with the cap and trade dollars, with purpose, with intentionality, written statutorily, so it's codified into law. It's not an executive decision by the governor. It's law. That you have to invest a minimum baseline of the auction revenue dollars in communities that are disproportionately impacted. Because if you don't, then those who have high educational attainment, those who live in the well-to-do areas in the peninsula, they will be the ones who benefit. Same thing, because you just sort of kind of, you know, triggered, for the University of California, as well as the CSU system. Because affirmative action is illegal in California due to Proposition 209, we found out that 80% of our kids graduate from high school. Relatively, it's a good number because the trajectory is going up. However, only half of them are actually eligible for admissions because they complete the A through G requirements. So we opened up 20,000 brand new enrollment slots, but also gave the high schools this year, $200 million so they can actually have the A through G courses on their campus. So you take an A through G, and then you compound that with honors classes, and you get these super hyper-weighted GPAs of 4.65. Back in our day, it used to be 4.0, and you were perfect, you know?
Or mine, 1.4.
Yeah. And then you doubly compound that, right, with AP classes, advanced placement classes. And then no wonder who gets into Cal, into UCLA, or to Stanford University, or MIT, or Brown, or Caltech, or elsewhere, University of Chicago. So it's not innate with regards to ability or lack of ability, but unless you move policies that connect it together and move it with intentionality and purpose, with leadership, and you have to burn political capital. Every climate change policy that we've discussed, none of it would have come to fruition unless we use the political capital. And we used it, and so far it's been quite successful.
Kevin DeLeon is president of the California State Senate. His other people here at Climate One today are Antonio Villaraigosa, former mayor of Los Angeles.
Villaraigosa,
did I get that right? And Melanie Mason from the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Dalton. We're talking about jobs and the economy at Climate One. Let's go to our audience questions. Welcome.
We've been talking with our mayor, Glenn Hendricks, in Sunnyvale about trying to get ahead of AB 32 and now SB 32, the extension. But he has mentioned that he thinks it's an unfunded mandate and there's nothing that forces the city to do anything. So what about the state policy and the state law now that can press cities to do what they need to do to lead, especially in Silicon Valley, to show the way?
Well, I think someone like the mayor, it's unfortunate to hear this from a city, a town like Sunnyvale in Santa Clara County, which is, you know, the birthplace of innovation for the world, that this type of thinking, which is quite surprising in the Bay Area. It's clear that if he doesn't move forward with the policies that California has set forth, he will set back Sunnyvale without a doubt, and therefore there'll be a negative economic impact for the city of Sunnyvale. Everyone deserves clean air, clean water. Everyone deserves economic growth and access to a job, how we recalibrate a new economy of tomorrow by creating the jobs. Be mindful about one thing. With our policies, we are actually recalibrating a new economy of tomorrow. Again, let me underscore and emphasize, we're not allowing the market forces, either in China, India, the European Union, or policies or lack thereof out of Washington, D.C., dictating the economic growth in California. We're actually sending the market signals from the policies, extension of our targets of AB 32, manifested in SB 32. It's quite unfortunate. If you like, I'll pick up the phone and I'll call the mayor myself personally, if you like.
Next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Anna Chalet, I'm a reporter with New American Media. This is a question about threats to the coastline. It's our understanding that the current Coastal Commission is pretty generally pro-development. And so my question is, are you worried about the Coastal Commission, and what do you think are the biggest threats to the coast right now?
Well, I think we have an amazing, beautiful coast in California, and it's been incredibly protected. It's unlike New Jersey or other parts of the country where you've seen massive overdevelopment at the cost of our environment, at the cost of access to our beautiful beaches in California. Relatively speaking, they're extremely pristine. There's been a lot of controversy with regards to several votes on the California Coastal Commission. I can say that my appointees on the California Coastal Commission, I believe, have voted the right way on a whole variety of issues. I do not want to see egregious development on our California coast, because we need to make sure that it is left for many generations to come. So obviously, there will be new appointments coming up. I know that for Marin County in San Francisco County, there will be a new appointment that I'll be making that represents this geographical area probably within the next few months.
Let's have our next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, my name is Jesse Rantry with the Nature Conservancy. California is often looked as the golden example of for our climate progress, and deservedly so, thanks to your great progress. But I want to look briefly beyond our state bounds. So what do you recommend we can do to scale up the success that we've seen in California and replicate it across other geographies, and ideally incentivize action at a federal level?
I think cities. When you look around the world, and I get to speak around the world, I tell you, mayors are leading the way. You were in Paris. I was in Copenhagen before that. The only place where there was real action was with the mayors, because the national governments were pointing fingers at one another and saying, you know who could do the least, back, particularly at Copenhagen, more than Paris. And, you know, the mayors were trying to see who could outdo one another. You know, the mayors have been leading the way across the country. Mayor of New York, Mayor of L.A., Mayor of San Francisco, Mayor of Portland, Mayor of Chicago, Mayor of Miami, all of us. I did the first adaptation. The state, I don't even know if they've even looked at the issue of an adaptation study. We did the most far-reaching adaptation, climate adaptation study in the world with UCLA. I didn't have to be told to do it. I did it knowing the coast. Venice is going to be impacted. You know, all along the coast with climate change, we're going to see the impact. So we didn't wait on, capital, state capital, or Washington, D.C. So I think that's where the action is. Big cities, particularly progressive cities. You know, Austin's another one. There's cities all around the country and the world, frankly, that are kind of leading this issue of climate change in a real concrete way.
But let me add something too, because this is important, because for a state like California, with all the different mayors and the different goals and the different targets, you do need to, at a macro level, to make sure you have one uniform target above the board that everyone's going to lead towards, because you can't have one mayor that says 20% RPS, another says 15% RPS, another one says I can only go this far, 25% RPS. That's why we're doing 50% RPS.
RPS is clean energy standards.
Renewable portfolio standard, which means that the IOUs and MOUs have to generate half of their electricity from either wind, solar, or geothermal. And that's why, as a subnational, we are not a leader, we are the leader in the entire world. Copenhagen, it was kind of disastrous, because things didn't really,
it was disastrous.
You know, and Paris was, because when we arrived in Paris, when California arrived, you know, when the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor arrived, we were treated like heads of states, because this is not theoretical, but this is real implementation and execution and verifiable goals, you know. So, but Antonio, I like Antonio's progressive vision, because it's, you don't get a lot of folks, you know, like Antonio or Ed Lee here, or Sam Liccardo in San Jose, or Libby Schaff across, you know, in the East Bay and in Oakland. You do need a unifying, you know, legislation at the state level that drives this. Short of that, you just have a hodgepodge quilt, and that's not good enough.
You're talking about clean energy.
He's absolutely right. But you create, when the big cities are laying this out, you create the political climate to get to show that it can work. And actually, the reason why Paris was such a success in comparison to Copenhagen because Paris and, well, I already said London, Copenhagen, Toronto, Berlin, LA, Mexico City, big cities around the country were not waiting on their national government. But the president pro tem is absolutely right. You know, what we need is for everybody to take, you know, follow along. And without the standards that AB 32 and SB 32 have put in place, we wouldn't be able to move as quickly as we did.
If we could only get, like you said, the local governments, state governments, at least California and other progressive states, Oregon, Washington, if we can only get our federal government. Yeah. We know our president, Barack Obama, has tried through the executive, you know, level through unilateral actions, executive actions, but we have a Congress right now that's still debating creationism versus evolution, you know?
Don't have passports.
The earth is still
30%
flat.
30% of them don't have passports.
Let's go to our next question. We're talking about clean energy at Climate One. Let's go to our... Welcome.
Yes,
real
I'm
quick.
Deborah
Sylvie. We've got 3 minutes left.
Yep. And I am a pensioner, a CalPERS pensioner, and I want to thank you, Senator De Leon, for your SB 185, the coal divestment bill that passed last year. It was very meaningful. We would like to know, I would like to know where it goes next, because actually there are still some companies that can, that the pensions can invest in that are still have holdings in coal. And also, I just wonder if you have any plans for following up with other fossil fuels. We would love to see that happen. Thank
Senator
you.
Senator DeLeon.
I will say that everything is on the table. And if you'd like to speak in further, I'm more than happy to, because I know I've been approached by many folks up and down the state if we'll take this a step further with regards to other types of fossil fuels. So I'll say I have an open mind.
Last question, quickly.
Hello, my name is Barbora. I'm a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby. And you mentioned you're uncertain about the pass of carbon tax or cap and trade, even if the majority of both chambers will be taken by the Democrats. What about the possibility of revenue-neutral carbon fee, and where do you stand on it?
Well, with the revenue carbon-neutral fee, I want to say everything's on the table, and I have a very open mind. I want to make sure we bring stability and continuity and a sense of certainty to the market. So therefore, if, as Melanie mentioned, if it's the lack of legal, it's the legal ambiguity, and if we need two-thirds vote to pass, to extend cap and trade, to get rid of the legal litigation against cap and trade, I want to make sure at a tactical level that we don't negotiate against ourselves, and we negotiate such a bad deal that we gut completely and undermine our climate change policies in California and our climate change leadership. On the issue of a carbon tax as well, too, I think everything's on the table. If we were actually secure the votes from either conservative Democrats or even Republicans, I'd be open to it. You want to make sure, because this is really hard stuff, and you want to make sure you don't end up negotiating against yourself or letting the perfect get in the way of the good. You want to leave what your baseline criteria is. We have to reach our targets. They're highly ambitious. I believe with certain investments in technology, we will reach our goals. But at the same time, we want to make sure we hit our targets and we provide for economic growth. Economic growth is absolutely key, because I do believe strongly by linking that together and saying, I have a job, energy efficiency, retrofits, window fenestration, double pane windows, lighting and sensors, jobs are labor intensive that must be done on site. And guess what? I got the job because of these policies. If we can put people to work and become less carbon intensive and clean up our air, we've met our goals. And we can export those policies to the rest of the state and around the world. That's why California is being watched very closely by the world.
We have to wrap it up there. Kevin DeLeon is president of the California State Senate. Other guests today at Climate One are Antonio Villaraigosa, former mayor of Los Angeles, and Melanie Mason, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to thank our audience here in the room at the Commonwealth Club and online. You can join us on Twitter using our handle at Climate One and listen to podcasts in Climate One and at the iTunes store. Let's thank them for their participation today. Climate One is the sustainability initiative at the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. I'm Greg Dalton, the executive producer. Kelly Pennington is our director of audience engagement. Jane Ann Chen is the producer. The audio engineer is William Bloom. The Commonwealth Club CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Join us next week for a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment.